Ferdini with the Go See Talk podcast experience. You're on this podcast because you love sound, you love what music does to you, and we are thrilled to have our next guest who offers a variety of services from composition to assistance to full productions. Robinson Hobbs is the co-founder of Joy Music House, and he is a talented composer and just a heck of a nice guy, so we're thrilled to have him on the show today. Robinson, how's things in your world?
Things are good. We have been very lucky, Joy Music House in particular, as a company that pretty much ever since we launched, which was back in 2018, the work has continued to roll in. So even with, COVID was bumpy, obviously, for everybody, but all things considered, we weathered that well. The work came back, and, we'll see what happens this fall. But right now with the strike, we're still continuing to find opportunities and, obviously doing a lot of documentary work and that sort of thing. So it's exciting times.
Well, I imagine there's things that, because of the nature of the production, I mean, you have things in the pipeline that have to be finished. So there's still, you still need to clear your plates before any new work comes. So I guess how is the current workload with great titles like It Ain't Over and Hellraiser and things like that?
It's good. We are doing an ABC Hulu show right now that we're score producing for Brocker Way. And we've got some projects lined up for August, some other things lined up for the fall. I think a video game that we did last year that may finally be coming out. We're at the end, music's at the end of the production cycle. So everything that has already been made right now is still coming our way. And so that gives us, with the ups and downs of the industry, the nice thing is that gives us a little leeway to have work coming in when other stuff is slowing down, and know, like, we get a little foresight, like, oh, we're going to be slow in 3 months because everyone else is slow right now. So we need to start the hustle now, which is advantageous.
But also the list of services you provide is quite extensive. And so it looks like you can do everything from composing to music prep to orchestration. So it's like you may not have the entirety of a project, but you can do bits and pieces. Can you kind of explain that breakdown in the a la carte?
Yeah, well, JMH, everybody on the team is a working composer. We have people who, like Ariel Marks, who was on our team in the beginning and then has since become busy enough that generally we work for her now. And then we have some people who are new and fresh out of, composition school. But everybody is working either as or towards being a film composer. So we start right at the top of, like, we can write music. And then we go all the way down to, whether it's arrangements or, mock-ups, MIDI cleanup, orchestration, and music prep is probably the bulk of the work that we do. But one of the things that really sets Joy Music apart from other prep houses is we don't just copy your music, send you a PDF, and sort of like, hey, good luck, have fun. We really work with the composer all the way through the process. We're in the studio producing the recordings alongside them, or sometimes for them, because a lot of our composers really trust what we're doing. So they're there and we're communicating constantly about takes and ideas, but we have a very hands-on approach. And the end result is we are really able to make sure those sessions deliver exactly what the client wants and for their film. How it came about, really, and the a la carte aspect is, in film music, well, there's this sort of broad perception that the composer is this, like, lone soul writing all this music at their piano or whatever, a la John Williams. It's not the case. The timelines alone, the production schedules, the demands on a composer are such that one person couldn't pull it off all by themselves And so everybody's, you know, has to have at least an assistant. A lot of people have teams of composers that they're working with to flesh out themes that they've written. And that costs a lot of money. So our goal was, if you're not, you know, Hans or you know, Lauren or whatever, you know, we are your one-stop team for whatever you need, whether that's for a few weeks, for 1 week. And so you hire us so that you, the composer, don't have to worry about anything other than writing music, and we can handle the rest in whatever capacity is needed to get the job done, and really usually to get the music out of the DAW and onto the stage.
Well, whether it's a team of one or five, what's a realistic expectation of music per day? I had heard at one point you need to produce 5 minutes a day, and that might be overly ambitious, or, you know, is that possible these days?
It's possible. 6 minutes a day is what I have heard commonly thrown around for TV. TV is the tightest deadlines, probably the, you know, most aggressive amount of work. Movies are a little bit slower usually. Video games tend to have a much longer production cycle, so that tends to be slower paced. They often tend to be immensely more in terms of volume of music, so there's always a trade-off. It's definitely doable. People are doing it. I think TV music has a reputation for being overly simple, and I think that's part of the trade-off, is that, you know, you can create, you can like write 6 minutes in a day, but it's not all going to be brilliant. It's not all going to be, you know, that nuanced boutique, you know, like this was really, really every moment of this crafted for every moment of this story, which you get more in films and that sort of thing. But the reality is you'll have some cues where you do that, but you're going to focus on those. And then the underscore is going to be the ones that kind of, you know, really get banged out. That's not to say it's not quality. The people who are doing this are writing, you know, solid work that, you know, fits the scene, fits the show. It's, you know, but it's not usually probably the music you're going to put on to listen to, because it's really there to serve a purpose, not to be necessarily musically exciting on its own.
You mentioned Hans earlier, and he had his MO for scoring something like 12 Years a Slave. He said, my only job was to stay out of the way of the story. And I would imagine that, kind of piggybacking what you're saying, that yes, there is not only so much music needed for TV. You know, I had a boss who said there's only one Ferris wheel at the carnival. You know, like, you don't want to make everything this wow, bam moment, because it, one, it doesn't narratively make sense. Two, just it's exhausting to do all that. So I see that. I know what you mean, that you need to sort of serve a purpose and be an underscore and waiting for the moments to shine. But let's take a step back from that. I mean, you got here because of a certain thing that drove you, you know, stuck in your ear, probably heard it at a very young age. Well, what got you moving? What gets you grooving? What do you like to put on in your spare time?
See, these days I listen to a lot of film and game scores because I'm just fascinated with what other people are doing. Like, at the end of the day, though I work in this industry, I'm still a fan. And I think that there's so much cool music being written, particularly, I think, in video games right now, where, like I said, I feel like people get a little more room to play around. I was a, you know, rock and roll person growing up. And then I played in punk bands and got very into metal and stuff like that for a while. But interspaced in all of that, you know, my dad, you know, would expose me to classical music and was always trying to convince me it wasn't boring. And one of the huge things, if we're talking about influences, is back in the day when video games were on CDs, or, you know, if you, there were some games, the Blizzard games in particular were like this, where if you put the CD in a CD player, the game disc, and skipped to track two, it would play the soundtrack. And so like, I know some of the Command and Conquer games did that. Warcraft 1 and 2 in particular, I remember just like looping those CDs for hours while I was just like, you know, doing whatever in middle school. And I think like, it just always stuck in my head. It's like, this is a cool thing, you know? And then it all, my dad finally got his victory when one summer I was a pool boy, and I was driving a truck around town, you know, scooping leaves out of people's pools and that sort of thing. And the company truck they gave me only had a radio, and I couldn't stand commercial radio. So I ended up spending the entire summer listening to the like public radio classical station. And by the end of the summer, I was coming home, you know, being like, baby, you got to check out this Tchaikovsky concerto, and like just stuff that I'd never nerded out on before. But, you know, you spend enough time listening to it and you're like, there's really cool pieces here. And so, you know, it just was a gradual shift more and more towards like, well, what can you do with an orchestra? And then I was like, I'm going to move to LA and be a film composer, because that won't be hard. So, yeah, and here I am. It's been a very bumpy but fun ride.
Well, I was watching Creed 3 this weekend, and I think there was a line in the movie that says, the higher you get, the tougher it gets. Like, mm-hmm. The idea that like the climb. And I remember I was watching on Netflix the new Schwarzenegger documentary, or no, it wasn't that, it was his he's gotten this very motivational speaking on his YouTube channel. Yeah. He said something to the effect of, he's like, look, he goes, do you think once I won Mr. Universe, it got easy? He's like, no, look at me every time I lift all this weight. I'm not smiling. This is difficult. So it's like, it's always a struggle. And it's like, you know, I'm sure you've seen the movie Layer Cake, right?
I have not.
Oh, okay. Well, then I don't want to spoil it for you, but there's a great monologue that Michael Gambon gives at the end of it, talking about like as you climb. So I'll let you and Jessica watch that on your own.
Yeah.
But the idea here, it's always a struggle, it's always a grind. And if, you know, there's that expression, if you're coasting, it means you're going downhill. So I, all that said, life is an arts struggle. But I'm glad you got that, you know, that exposure, because that did open your mind to, you know, what could be. And I like that you listen to things that are maybe outside what you're doing at work, because it just, you know, like, what's the current temperature? What are the cool kids doing? You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've definitely hit the age now that I don't understand what the cool kids are doing, but I do think it's interesting to keep checking it out. And there's times where the radio where I'm like, I don't know why this is cool, but there are really interesting things happening here, even if it's not what I want to go home and like jam to. Mm-hmm. It's always interesting, and it's always interesting to see what's, you know, in film music, we do new things, but we do a lot of old things, and we recycle things. And then depending on the project, you know, it's super normal for someone to come in and have temped something with a whole bunch of Bernard Herrmann or something, because it's still very relevant in what we do, even though like hip wise, it's very old. So it's also interesting watching film music, because I don't think we have some clear trends. You know, like, you know, Trent Reznor shook everything up when his score started coming out, and suddenly everybody wanted that sound. But it's not like the asks for more traditional film music go away. And it's also the genre where you can do basically anything, and there's somebody who wants that in their project, which I think is really cool.
Well, you mentioned video games a while ago. I remember I talked to Brian Tyler, and I said, what's more difficult, writing film music or video games? And he goes, without missing a beat, he goes, yeah, it's writing video game music, because you have to write music for all the eventualities that a character may encounter. And kind of like you said, the volume is just so vast. But it's also, in a way, some video games are very linear, some are very like open world and exploratory. So how do you maybe work on a project where it's not def like with a movie, if the character's going this way, you got to ride, triumphant music while he's on his horse. But if a guy's just sort of exploring the world, is there a driving theme? Is it more atmospheric and blanket music? How does the approach work?
Yeah, this is, I think, actually one of the great sort of divides in film composers is I find people skew one way or the other. They prefer film because it's more linear, because you're really working to hit all of those beats just right and really like craft the emotion of the scene. And I skew video games. Stylistically, film is fun, but sometimes I feel a little trapped. Like it only goes this way, and if I come up with a really cool idea, but it's two beats too long, I have to chop it up to make it work. And that frustrates me because sometimes I think my idea is better. But video games, yeah, it's a vibe. It's an ambiance, which doesn't necessarily mean ambient music, but you're saying, what is the sonic palette of this area? What is, what does wandering around in here feel like? And how do I write music, as you said, that maybe they'll be here for 2 minutes, maybe they'll be here for 20 minutes because they can't solve the puzzle, or maybe they just like this zone, so this person keeps coming back. And how do you create music that works for that? And it tends to be, I mean, it's really hard to generalize because there's so much in gaming and so many different things that work. But I run into two basic things. One is layers that can be blended in and out. So you have a track with, 15 instruments going, but depending on what's going on, maybe you're only hearing four of them. But if you're in an area and you've got just like a light drum thing and some drones and maybe a flute going on, and then you get attacked, well, then there's all these other pieces that have already been written. It's all the same piece, but now when we get to whatever the loop cycle is or however they trigger it, we're going to bring in that string ostinato, we're going to bring in the heavier percussion, and we're going to amp up. And when it's done really well, you don't really notice it. It just feels like one fluid piece of music. And then the fight's over, you can pull them back down. And so you get a dynamic experience within a single area of a game. And the other one I've seen is instead of doing a, 2 minute cue, you might do 5 or 6 15 to 30 second cues. So not quite a stinger, but things that kind of can fade in and play music for a little bit and then drift out. And that way you can, as the game is changing, pretty quickly, you're going to hit a point where it makes sense to transition this cue into this cue because they're all short. And so you can just tell the game, okay, when this one ends, play the more dramatic one, or however they want to code that. And the implementation of it is really exciting too, because there's a challenge as a writer, even if you're not the one implementing it, which is becoming, it used to be you had to. If you were the composer on a video game, you were also putting it in the game, but it's becoming much more common to just be writing the music. But you still need to understand functionally how they're going to be using it, because you have to write to fit that paradigm. I find those puzzles, those challenges really like exciting, and it makes me go home and be like, oh man, how do I make this work?
Well, that's really cool, and I the only thing I can follow that up with is I spoke to Jake Kaufman about the work he did for DuckTales and Shovel Knight and like the original DuckTales on the NES. If you were to get the magic coin, it gives you invincibility, I want to say it's like a half second cue, but the way it, or second and a half, but the way it sort of undulates on itself, it lasts as long as, you know, you have the power up for. So I think that's really cool, the way, mm-hmm. what you said, these little things that can feather in and feather out and become, you know, whether it's down or up, depending on the dynamic play. But I remember I was playing this Star Wars game on my phone, and you got to Bespin, right? So like you're in this action scene, and they took John Williams's asteroid chase theme, and what it did is it took that, you know, 2-3 minutes and just ran it through, but it ends while you're still in battle, so it has to, like, it has its own little climactic arc that mm-hmm. has nothing to do with the video game. And I think that was like, yes, it was cool to use that iconic thing, but it didn't make sense to what was happening. So mm-hmm. that was what I think was a unfortunate fail. But I don't know where I was going with that. This is just cool talking to you about this stuff. But
yeah, but that's the thing, right? Is a lot of times it needs to be able to loop, and film music absolutely does not. So the only way to fix that would have been to, you know, rewrite the end of that cue so that it can go back into the beginning. And I see a lot of games, the music is semi-ambient. So it'll start with a pad and something simple and then build into a little bit of a piece and then really tail out. And that just makes it easy to crossfade. And you know, it's a little bit of, you don't have to have like a hard, like, and it ends and then we need it to hit the one, you know, you just, you know, because I've done those loops too for like a boss battle, and you're, it's like, it really has to work. And sometimes, you know, you want like that cymbal swell at the end, but then the tail doesn't carry over unless you have a matching cymbal swell at the start. So, you know, things you would normally do to build up like a climactic end don't work in a loop. You have to do it sooner and then sort of come back down, or make sure that swell goes up and then it starts with a hit, with a cymbal hit, so it still sounds natural.
Well, where in the process do you learn that? I mean, do you
doing it wrong a lot, mostly.
No, what I was going to ask was, you know, there's the idea of writing music. To somebody like myself, I think that someone's just doing, you know, freehand writing versus actually orchestrating it, putting it together, and the, you know, 6 minutes, you may write what is essentially 6 minutes, but then producing it and having a fully fleshed out 6 minutes, where in that process do you realize the, you know, whether you're going down the wrong path or not, or the things won't line up?
Ooh, I don't know if, you know, there's not an exact moment, but definitely it's watching it back. You know, the upside of the DAW is that you can listen back without playing it, you know, so you've programmed or you've played in your stuff, and then you can listen back and then you change a couple things and then you listen back. And so when I'm working with a movie, obviously you have the picture and you're watching it and you take the dialogue track in and out to see how it's working versus just how the music's working. On a video game, I almost always want to be working with footage from the game, even if it's like non-linear and this won't be exactly how it goes. It's like I like to be able to watch it while watching somebody run around and you know, do the thing and hear the sound effects and hear if they're clashing with the music and that sort of thing. And I think when it's not working, you just hit a point where you realize that, like, partway through you're like, this isn't the right vibe, this this isn't going to work, this loop won't work, these chords are just not right, my tempo's wrong, whatever it is. And it's always further along in the piece than you'd like to be to start over, I feel like. But I find in my work, almost nothing gets wasted. There's a lot of times where I wrote a cue and maybe I didn't even send it to the team. Maybe partway through I said, this won't work. So I just copy it off to the side in my session somewhere. And then later I'll go, oh, that thing I did before will totally work here. Or I go on a lot of walks for my creative cycle, and I'll be in the middle of a walk and I'll be like, oh, if I go back and I chop this up and I take that out and I put this thing, it's going to work in this other scene. And I cannibalize all my music all the time because I'm working on a podcast right now. And I would say every episode, there's at least one cue that I realize that won't work here at all, but it's going to totally work in one of the future episodes. They're all narrative, so I kind of know the themes of each story. So the other thing I do these days is, you know, with MIDI and samples and all the cool stuff we have, it's a really fancy spreadsheet is what it is that plays music back to you. It's not quite as organic as I wish it was, but there's a lot of fiddly detailed work that goes into making all those samples sound really cool and as lifelike as possible, or larger than life, because so much of producing this music is not recreating the sound of an orchestra in a room, but like something bigger than that. And what I found is I've spent 8 hours, and at the end of the day, I have 4 bars, and they sound really, really good, but it's not a usable piece of music. So what I do now is I primarily write in a piano patch. I use very simple, like cheap MIDI patches, or they can be good, but I'm not fiddling with them. I'm just getting the general idea down. And that is so that when I realize, oh, this piece isn't working, or I need to change this, or I need to, you know, I haven't spent hours and hours tweaking it. I'm just getting the notes and the chords and the melodies down. And I figure that if everything sounds good in bad MIDI, like if it melodically, harmonically sounds good, then it's going to sound great when I put in the time to, you know, really finesse it.
Okay. Well, I grew up on MIDI and Sound Blaster, and I have some games from the Sierra days that just still to this day blow my mind. And I think by virtue of it, I was talking to Paul Leonard Morgan, and I said, well, what is it about video game music that people are so in love with? It's like, is it just the catchy themes? And he goes, no, it's because it beats you over the head for 60 hours. And it's, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, yeah. But it's like, you know, you play and you play, you're like, oh, okay, well, now it's in my DNA forever. But what games spoke to you? What ones do you really love, whether it was just the gameplay or the music? Or, you know, let's go down a rabbit hole of things that impressed young Mr. Hobbs.
Yeah. I have a very deep set, core part of my being that is just the Diablo games, like 1 and 2. I realized that because 4 just came out, and I haven't had a chance to play it yet because I've been really busy, but I was checking out the soundtrack, and, you know, there's a few little throwbacks to some of the earlier melodies, and it just hits you it's the same, you know, we all probably feel that with, you know, if you're into film music, like, you know, hearing the Jurassic Park theme or something like that, a movie that was, you know, but I get those like 12 string guitar chords, and I'm just like, oh yes, I gotta go kill some demons. That was a huge one. The Warcraft games as well were a big impact on me. Sort of throwing, you know, and those early Warcraft, the first two are not good MIDI. You know, they have that not quite chiptune, but it's that middle like PlayStation 1 era where you can tell, oh, that's kind of supposed to be an oboe and that's kind of brass and those are strings, but they're not nice. And on that, actually, on that same note, the score to Final Fantasy Tactics is probably one of my favorite of all time. It's that same, like, cheap, barely realistic at all MIDI, but the writing is just incredible. It's so good. And I've heard some people on the internet have done pretty solid, you know, orchestral mock-ups with modern tools, but Yeah, if I came into vast wealth, I would literally go back and be like, I want to record that whole soundtrack with like a real orchestra. And I don't know if it'd be as good because it's, you know, nostalgia. I sometimes wonder if, just like there's people who are really into chiptune, if there's going to be at some point like a retro movement where we're all doing like late 90s, you know, MIDI sounds because people just have a nostalgic vibe. Because I'm a person who I don't get chiptune at all. Like, I'm just like, you know, some people really, really love that. And I got into games mostly on PC. I didn't have a console growing up. So that Final Fantasy is the exception. And that was because it was like the game like me and my friend would play all the time on his PlayStation. But so I missed the chiptune thing in my development. What else, man?
Well, PC games. What, I mean, could you talk about Diablo? That was what, like 94, 95?
Yeah, something in there.
Yeah, I kind of got into like Heart of China and Eco Quest and, like I said, some of the Sierra and Dynamics games, but, like the Batman on the NES, Chippendale's Rescue Rangers, that was okay. All like, you know, DuckTales was huge for me. But then like when you got to PlayStation, it was definitely Castlevania Symphony of the Night, and Ridge Racer 4. You're mm-hmm. right. I mean, some of these, the way they constructed these, I mean, the I wouldn't say orchestration because it's not properly orchestrated, but just the thematic writing that they came up with is just, it's phenomenal.
Yeah. It's brilliant. And the, I will say this, the amount of range they're getting out of basically, you know, one sound, you know, is really, it really is impressive. You know, it's a little bit like I was saying about writing with just a piano patch or not fully fleshing out my MIDI. You know, if you're working with, you know, the 16-bit sound or whatever they're doing, like it has to be thematically and, you know, melodically, harmonically, right on, because that's all you have. You don't have texture. And I do a lot of ambient music, and I love just layering pads and creating those like weird textures and things. But there's something to, you know, yeah, when all you have is these basic sounds, and you have to make something cool that you can beat somebody over the head with for like 8 hours straight, which, you know, yeah, me and my friends would sit down sometimes and do play games all day long, literally. And so it's, you know, it's really impressive writing. No question.
You've got a workshop that Joy Music House offers. You want to talk about that after a little bit?
Yeah, so we have launched the Joy Music House score production workshop, and it's a month long process, but it's like once a week we have Zoom classes, and then it culminates in a full weekend of recording sessions. And basically, what we're doing is it's a masterclass walking people through how we produce the recordings that we do for film scores. You know, talking about the preparation for all of it. But really the focus is on being in the studio, how to communicate with the musicians, how to troubleshoot, you know. And then once we get into the studio, in the mornings, we're producing music with the class they're observing. And then in the afternoon, each participant gets a spot in the hot seat, and they get a half an hour producing some of their work that they've written for this purpose. So like we have a day of strings, and then we have a day of brass and woodwinds. And we really, you know, kind of throw you into it. And the weeks leading up are to really prepare you for the process, because once you're in the chair, we're kind of going to cut you loose, and we're not going to hold your hand and let you really experience it, because it's hard. And it's stressful, and you know, in studios, you know, time is money. So you know, when things go wrong, you feel like you're just tearing up $20 bills, because, you know, so this is really really a way to like sink your teeth in and prepare for this process. So if you're a working composer who wants to elevate your ability to work with live musicians and add that to your score, which we all know is so often what makes that score really pop. Yeah, we're going to throw you in and we're going to, you know, teach you how to do it. So we're doing the first one in August here in LA. And then we're looking at maybe New York and London. We've had people in Singapore and Hong Kong looking at maybe us coming there to do a workshop. So the goal is really to, you know, take this on the road and bring it internationally and just, you know, elevate. We're in addition to just the work we do, like, you know, JMH has always been very focused on community and, you know, elevating not just the craft of what we do, but the people in it and bringing people together. And so the idea of being able to travel the world and connect with different communities of composers around the world and then help them elevate their craft is pretty much the most exciting thing for me.
Well, that's phenomenal. And so I think you kind of answered my next question. So the prerequisite is you have to have some experience. You can't just come in with a heartbeat and a hope. You actually have to be somewhat in the business or a profession, because this is not like 101, you're saying. This is
advanced tactics. It is. You know, we want to hear some samples, and we want in particular to have some score sample, like notation samples from each person, so that we know they've got a basic understanding of how to put this together. Cause that's, you know, while we will help you fine tune that process, that's not really the goal of the class. And it's for people who, you know, I would think are, you know, in a position where they really want to apply this to their work, because it's not theoretical, it's very hands-on. Yeah, I would say the target audience is working composers, but we have people, you know, right out of school who are kind of taking this as their next step, and you know, they've learned these basic skills and they're getting their degree and now they want to elevate this part, and I think that's a strong fit as well. But you would be a little in over your head if you had never, you know, never done a film and just thought it would be neat. That's true.
Gotcha. All right. Well, yeah, I remember talking to Marco Beltrami, and he said something to the effect of one of the things that you learn as a young composer just by being around people in the industry is it's not about composing. It's not about the, you know, putting a tune together. It's actually about the, you know, the nature of the communication with the client and delivering what is asked for. And just those, you know, simple things that they don't seem to be intuitive to be like, oh, okay, I'm just going to write the best 12 bars in the history of the universe. Well, right. There's more to it. So I'd like that more nuanced approach and just working with connecting people, making things happen.
Yeah, it's definitely that. And then, you know, every time I'm in the studio, I learn something. There's nothing quite like taking your music and having actual players perform it. For you to go, oh, that's what that sounds like. Sometimes good, or sometimes like, wow, that's not what I thought I was notating, because everything sounds good in the DAW, kind of, you know, because the samples were recorded to sound really good. But there's so many other factors that go into live music that, you know, every time I record my own music, I become a better composer because I get a better understanding of like what I've actually asked these musicians to do and how and what they do to create the sounds that I want. And then when I go back and write, I have a deeper understanding of what I actually want to get when I go into the studio.
Well, let's take a pause for a second. Where did you get that fascinating Dolly clock behind you?
Oh, I have no idea. My wife found it online somewhere, I think, and ordered it. And yeah, It's cool.
There's a line in Guy Ritchie's Rock and Rolla where he goes, "You know, a man's cultured when he has a Whistler." I would say a man's cultured when he has some sort of dolly in the background.
Yeah.
Excellent work.
Yeah. Thanks, man. Yeah, it's fun. It runs slow, so it does not keep the time, but somehow that feels absolutely fitting.
Well, let's talk about some more fun stuff. I mean, I guess, you know, by virtue of you being in the industry, I guess, you know, I'd like to talk about how you like to unwind, but also what do you find that are your strong suits? What are your things that, like, this I'll knock out of the park every time, this I always need this person to help me with? And how do you, you know, use the resources of Joy Music to, you know, put a full thing together based on everyone's strengths?
Yeah. I'm very good big picture, which is kind of why I have the role I do within the company, which is a lot of just sort of running the day-to-day show, keeping track of just, you know, what projects are going on or coming up, who's on what do we need to follow up on, what's due this week, and we have spreadsheets and all of that. For that. Interestingly, I'm not always the most detail-oriented person. So it works really well when I can, like, guide the broad strokes and then, you know, connect with somebody one-on-one to sort out, like, exactly the specifics of, you know, I'm a person where, and this is the same whether it's, you know, business management or writing music, I feed off of interaction with somebody else. So I don't like working in a void. And as soon as I start talking to somebody, I get like six other ideas. And it's just, you know, it's almost like therapy, right? You know, where you sit down and the whole point you're talking with them and they're going, uh-huh. And then by the end, they've just guided you into realizing something you needed to figure out. And I find that I do that professionally, where sometimes I'm sit down and I'm like, I'm having this problem. I'm hoping you help me figure out how to solve this. I think this and this, and they'll say like one thing and I'm like, yeah. And then also this and that and that and this. And somehow that interaction is what like makes the engines of my brain kick on. You know, consequently, I'm always like reaching out to people on our team to make that happen for myself. And, you know, in the end, that's good because it keeps us all talking. We're not in an office, right? We're all working from home in our own studios and we have a Slack channel and all of that. That's how we keep it going. Musically, like I like everything. I was a punk and metal dude. I like things over the top. I like everything bigger than everything else. I tend to write a big piece of music and then sort of pare it back to be what it actually needs to be. And I write orchestra like it's heavy metal because that's just where my head is. That's how I think. I didn't go to classical composition school. I've studied a lot of scores and, you know, but it's just me picking them apart and figuring out what's going on. And the same way I would, you know, learn like, you know, rock music tracks on my guitar growing up. It's just me figuring it out and deconstructing it myself. And so that's still really how I approach music. So I'm really good at that. You know, I'm rambling a bit, so sorry, but my critique when I'm listening back to music, you know, my metric is basically, does it rock? Does it hit me? Does it make me be like, yeah, I'm into this? It's a vibe thing. Some people are very nuanced about what's happening, you know, theoretically, music theory wise, or all these things. But to me, it's more of a you know, I've studied theory, I understand that, but it's got to hit a vibe. And if it hits that, then I know it's working. And I can do that with myself, but I can do it with other people pretty well too. Just listen and see if I get that, like, you know, like, does this rock, you know? And it can be a lullaby, but it's got to like give you that this, you know, that emotional connection the same way you would with songwriting. And I think I approach scores in that way a lot. You know, I still believe in hooks. I still believe in all the things. If it works in a pop song, you can apply that to film score. You just have a different end goal with what you're doing. But then I like to, you know, we do internally within JMH, we have a Slack channel called Q Club, where we'll share things if we want people to give us thoughts on what we're working on. And I really like that, because then I'll bring, you know, my thing in and get thoughts from someone who's maybe very classically trained or was a jazz person, like Catherine, my business partner. And so then it gives you a radically different perspective on things. And that just makes everybody's music better, I think.
Precisely. If you design in a vacuum, no one's going to be able to call you on mistakes you made or maybe the things you didn't know. And I think that that's it's so beneficial to have a real collaborative effort, just to, you know, just for a second pair of eyes, second pair of ears. I was, you know, like you mentioned earlier, you said you'd work 8 hours and you'd have four bars that sound really good, but I could spend 8 hours on a floor plan drawing up a hotel room, and I can go, you know, and I went to my boss one day, I was like, I just don't know what to do. And literally, just without even looking, he's like, put the toilet there. Like, oh my God. You know, just yes. that one thing, like I didn't see it. So.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the best art is somewhat collaborative like that. And for me, that's all it takes usually, is like one little piece of the puzzle, and then you build the rest of it from that. But it gets you through that roadblock. I actually wish there was a physical Joy Music House. It doesn't make sense financially, but I would love to, like, if we all had our little like studio rooms and maybe a tracking room down at the end and a public like sort of break area, I would love to pop out and just be like, hey, you want to come in and just like listen to this scene real quick, give me your thoughts, or, you know, and just like, I think if we were doing that every day, it would be such a fantastic creative environment. And I've heard about people who used to be shops like that, where people who were songwriters or like jingle writers, and they'd all actually be at work, but they're each like writing in their little room. And I think that's really cool. And I think, you know, the one downside of the modern, you know, music industry, particularly, you know, film music, is that it's very isolated. And so many people really are just, you know, in their studio by themselves for hours and hours a day. And you have to find ways to get out of and connect with other musicians and composers and, you know, not just for your mental health, but for your creative processes. I think it makes everything much more interesting and dynamic.
But also too, I mean, I wouldn't say that composers are always alone, because they're, no. You know, they are, well, I know you're generalizing, but the idea that you're getting input from a producer or a director, so you're kind of helping fulfill their vision. If you're not in one physical location, or there's a lot of siloing or remote locations, how do you deal with the clients, and who are these working composers getting the most direction or instruction from?
It's a lot of Zoom and phone calls, sending files over Dropbox and that sort of thing. You know, I've watched a lot of people do spotting sessions now. It's entirely digital. They're watching down the same thing, but they're not together in a room. And I think it's fine. Maybe I just vibe off of people in my particular way so well. I would always prefer to spot a movie with the director in a room. I think you just really get each other so much more. I think people, you know, do pick up on emotions and, you know, vibrations or whatever, right? And when you're together, and that will always be my preference. But you're right, like, we can do so much, and it is really cool, you know, that if we all have an internet connection, you know, I can be here in LA, the director could be in London, there could be a producer in New York, and we can all come together and make a movie. And that's also just mind-blowingly awesome. It blows my mind all the time. Like, I try not to lose that luster. I mean, every time I fly, I'm like, I can't believe this works. I can't believe we can do, like, this is insane.
Well, you know, the scary thing is you think about this, like, how was it 60 years ago? You know, how was it? You couldn't just pick up a phone and call somebody. You had to actually physically plan a meeting, get a travel agent, fly. Somebody might miss their flight. And it just, the level at which, I mean, you're almost working at the speed of thought, because everybody's, you know, like, focused in at the same time on the same. And in a way, I think it yields, sometimes it yields too many options or too many opinions. I mean, think about, like, let's say somebody didn't show up and you just make the decision, well, we decided this was better and here's what you get, versus now everybody has a say in. It's just the nature of a creative process. But, well, Robinson, let's spend the last 10 minutes rocking out. You mentioned that quite a few times. I just bought the new Winger album. It's their seventh album. It is badass. What have you bought or listened to recently? What's rocking your world?
What is rocking my world? You know, you ask me that and my mind goes totally blank. I listen to music all the time. I saw there's a rock band here in LA called Dorothy that I saw at the Troubadour recently. That was really fun. They had Slash come out and play a song, which was super That's cool. Awesome. And then we go to the Troubadour a lot, my wife and I, because, you know, it's like kind of the OG rock and roll venue here in LA. And it's just a great venue. So we'll hang out after the show a lot. And we were hanging out, you know, just having a drink at the bar. And then this woman was, you know, easily 85 or something. And she came in and she had kind of a couple, you know, handlers, you know, just like, she was like, oh, this is somebody, you know, and she came up and so we were talking to her, and then we found out she used to, like, manage the venue, and she used to do booking, and she used to, like, book Slash there. So that's, you know, and Guns N' Roses. So that's why she was there, because she came down to, like, see her old buddy, like, play a song. And I was like, that is just so cool. And I love, you know, one thing that's fun about going to shows in LA is there's so many artists here. So the odds of that happening are really high, you know, of various surprise guests and all these, just, or just people being at the show where you're like, oh, that's that person, you know, and it's fun.
Well, I've recently got into, probably about 2 years ago, actually a little more than that, Bandcamp, the independent music platform.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I started a small series here on the site, so I've gotten to speak to a bunch of artists that I really have turned my ears and heart upside down with their, you know, what they do with music. And one of the best ones and my favorite ones is a guy named Ultra Boss. His name is PJ D'Artri. He's out of Austria. Shreds like the best of them, and he's my go-to fix when I need to rock out. So if you get a chance to check out Ultra Boss, I think you might like his stuff.
All right, I'll give it a whirl. I've been super into do you know Devin Townsend?
Well, I don't think so.
So he does a lot of metal, but he was in a band called Strapping Young Lad, which is like very extreme metal. But this guy does everything from like the most like blistering, bass melting, screaming blast beats, you know, technical death metal stuff to like pure, you know, ambient with like little flutes and you're just like on a beach somewhere. Everything in between. The guy's a maniac. And so talented. He's got like a vocal range the size of the whole piano. It's just like an absurd amount of talent in one dude. And yeah, I would recommend checking out his music because there's like something for everyone. And he's become one of my favorite artists. It's really, awesome. Really cool stuff.
Well, I really want to thank you, Mr. Robinson Hobbs, for your time, your energy, your passion, telling us all about JMH, and it's been GLAD to meet you. Everyone, check out everything. I mean, this is, you look at the services offered by this incredible composing roster, bullpen, composition, additional music, music editing, arranging, synthesization, mock-up, orchestration, copying, music preparation, Pro Tools session setup, and that's a lot.